Well, it's good of you to be here today. My name's Kent Hovind. I was a high school science teacher for 15 years. And now for the last 10 years, I've been traveling around the world speaking on creation, evolution, and dinosaurs. In my seminar, I cover what the Bible says about the age of the earth. The Bible teaches this earth is not billions of years old. It says God made the world about 6,000 years ago, not millions of years ago. And 4,400 years ago, there was a flood that destroyed the world when Noah built the big boat and saved all the critters on board. Now, before the flood came, the world was very different. We covered all that on videotape number one, how the earth was very different, why the people used to live to be 900 years old, and they used to live to be more than 900, and where the giant dinosaurs fit in. They were just big lizards that lived with Adam and Eve before the flood came. And then Noah took dinosaurs on the ark. People say, dinosaurs on the ark, they're kind of big, aren't they? Well, the big ones were big, but the little ones were little. Oh, duh. And Moses, or Noah, was 600 years old when he built that boat. He was smart enough to figure out you don't have to bring the biggest ones you can find. You bring two babies. Just be sure to get a pink one and a blue one. That's all you got to worry about. And then after the flood was over, man killed off most of the dinosaurs. Back in those days, they called them dragons. And they killed off most of the dinosaurs, plus the climate change killed a lot of them. Before the flood, they lived to be 900. After the flood, lifespans dropped off right away. If you read your Bible, they went down to 400 and then 200 and then 100. And today, hardly anybody makes it to 100. So dinosaurs died off from the climate change and from man's hunting. But a few are probably still alive today. A few small ones, and we cover all that on video number two about Loch Ness Monster, Lake Champlain Monster, the Mokele Mbembe in the Congo Swamp, and all that stuff. How many have seen that videotape on dinosaurs that are still living? That'd be one you might want to watch. But the evolution view says the world started 20 billion years ago with a big bang. Of course, they don't know what exploded or where it came from, but they think there was a big bang. And then 4.6 billion years ago, the Earth cooled down, developed a hard rocky crust, and it rained on the rocks for millions of years and turned them into soup. And the soup came alive about 3 billion years ago. That's what they teach in the schools. And this early life form found somebody to marry. Pretty good trick. And something to eat. And he slowly evolved into all of us today. That's the evolution view of history. These are the only two options of history that I'm aware of, that either somebody made the world or the world made itself. And somebody is clearly wrong, and I enjoy showing them who they are. So that's what I get to do as I travel around. I go tomorrow to Detroit to do a debate against a professor there. I do debates all over the place on creation and evolution and dinosaurs and this type of thing. But today, I want to talk a little bit about what the flood, this flood in the days of Noah, what caused the world to flood? I mean, doesn't it kind of sound strange? The whole world would flood. I was in a debate one time at the University of West Florida, and one of the students said, Mr. Hovind, is it possible for it to rain enough to flood the whole world? I said, oh, no, absolutely not. He said, but you think the whole world was covered, don't you? I said, yep, sure do. Now, how is it possible to flood the whole world? And what formed the mountain ranges that we see anyway, and the canyons? And what about the Ice Age? Where does that fit into the picture? Well, we're going to cover some of these things tonight, for today. But the Bible teaches us, knowing this first, there shall come in the last days scoffers. Did you know there are people that scoff at the Bible? I deal with them on a regular basis. Man, I attract them like a lightning rod. These scoffers, it says, are going to walk after their own lust. See, the reason they scoff at the Bible is because of their lifestyle. There's no scientific reason to reject the Bible. Nobody's found anything scientifically wrong with it. But they just don't like it because it chaps their hide. Well, they better get some Vaseline then because they're going to need it. We're going to be judged according to this book. And they say, that, I don't like that book. They walk after their own lusts. That's the problem right there. And they're going to say, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were. In other words, these scoffers are going to say, hey, the way it's happening now is the way it's always been happening for millions and billions of years. Long, slow, gradual processes. And the Bible says these scoffers are willingly ignorant. That means dumb on purpose. The scoffers are willingly ignorant of how God made the heavens. Now, the word heaven is plural, heavens. There's more than one heaven. And we talk about that on the first videotape. The scoffers are ignorant of how God made the heavens, three heavens actually mentioned in the Bible, and how the earth was out of the water and in the water. And they're also ignorant of how the world was overflowed with water. It was destroyed. This entire world was destroyed by a flood. Now see, the scoffers don't want to admit there was a flood because that means God has the right to judge his creation. And he does, by the way. This is his world. He can wreck it if he wants. See, they don't want to admit God flooded the world because then that might mean God might judge the world again. And he's going to, by the way. I saw a bumper sticker that said, Jesus is coming, and boy, is he mad. I thought, man, that'll preach. That's the truth, isn't it? He's coming soon, folks. Now, we'll talk about a few things in this session here about the flood. What caused the flood in the days of Noah? What about Pangaea? How many of you have ever heard or been taught that the continents used to all fit together in one big supercontinent called Pangaea? Well, where does that fit into the Bible? Or did it happen? Is it true? What about the Ice Age? Is it true the ice came all the way down to Kansas City, Missouri? Oh, yeah. Where does that fit into the Bible? And what froze the mammoths? The big, huge, hairy, hippie elephants that are found frozen up in Siberia, standing up. And how did the mountains and oceans form anyway? How does all this fit into the Bible? And why would the world suddenly flood? I mean, that sounds kind of strange. For the whole world to flood? How did that happen? Could it really rain enough to do that? Where'd all the water go? I mean, if the world was flooded, where is all that water? And what's the evidence for all this? So in this session, we're going to try to answer some of those basic questions. Now, what about Pangaea? The textbook says all the continents used to fit together. Almost every textbook shows you a map like this and says all the continents used to fit together in one big supercontinent, and they broke apart, you know, 200 million years ago. They'll usually say something like that. They always say South America and Africa seem to fit. Well, that's pretty true, the way they draw it on the map. But I'll show you some changes they made that they don't want to tell you about. The evidence they use to support this continental drift theory is that the continents seem to fit. Okay? They also say there are similar fossils found on opposite sides of the ocean. Well, that could be because there was a worldwide flood. That would form similar fossils all over the place, wouldn't it? Or they could float anywhere. And they talk about the Mid-Atlantic Ridge having magnetic lines, and that's supposed to be proof for the separating of the continents. There are some serious problems with all this. Here's what they don't tell you. In order to make that map you saw in your textbook, Africa was shrunk by 40% to make it fit. They didn't tell you about that, did they? They took Mexico and Central America out to make it fit. They don't tell you that Europe and South America have been rotated counterclockwise and Africa has been rotated clockwise to make them fit. Looks real good when they put it in the textbook, but there's a lot of deceit behind all that, folks. That is not quite as simple as they make it look. And they also don't tell you that the ocean is not quite the way it looks on a globe. If you look at a globe of the world, you notice there's a lot of blue material. We call that the ocean. But the oceans have two distinct parts, the deep part and the shallow part, called the continental shelf. This map right here from National Geographic, if you look at the map of South America and Africa, yeah, they look like they might fit together. You say, well, there's blue in between, there must be water. Well, that's true, but that water has two different depths. There's the deep part and the shallow part. The continental shelf of all the continents does not necessarily line up at all. If you lower the water a few hundred feet, the continental shelf would be exposed. We'll talk more about that later, about how this is not really the shape of the continent, the shape that we see above water level. Now, it is true the Earth has cracks all over it. San Andreas Fault, the New Madrid Fault, the Hayward Fault, I've seen them, been there, done that. None of them are my fault, but I've studied them. Okay? There's no question the Earth has these fault lines, these cracks all over, and the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. But how did they get that way? That's the question. You always got to keep in mind, if you're going to study science, you know, there might be two ways to look at things. And if you're only being shown one way, you might not be being educated. They might be indoctrinating you instead of educating you, showing you all the different options. In the textbooks, they show the bottom of the ocean having these Mid-Atlantic Ridge lines. How many have ever seen those before? Those lines at the bottom of the ocean, okay, supposed to be some kind of Mid-Atlantic Ridge. They say the magnetic field of the Earth has reversed. Absolutely not true. Pure deception on somebody's part. This quote here helped to explain. It is clear that the simple model of uniformly magnetized crustal blocks of alternating polarity does not represent reality. There are no magnetic reversals in the ocean floor. There are only areas of weak magnetism. Now, that makes a big difference. See, if the continents split apart a little bit, during the flood, when the fountains of the deep broke open, the crust of the Earth split. Water came shooting up, water that used to be under the crust. We'll talk about that in a minute. And that would let the subfloor of the ocean bulge up. Now, when rock is hot, it does not retain its magnetic strength. Magnetic lines can move around. When they show you in a textbook what this looked like, they're going to show you the nice, neat lines, you know, of all these magnetic lines. That's not what they really find down there. What they really find is a jumbled up mess. The lines are caused by the bulging of the Earth, and the rock rips or cracks, and the water rushes into the crack and cools it down. The water rushing and cooling off this rock changes the magnetic structure of the rock. See, hot basalt, which is the type of rock down there, hot basalt loses its magnetism. So what they have here is areas of weak magnetism and strong magnetism, but none of them are actual reversals. There is no place on the ocean floor where a north-pointing compass will point south. No place. There are no magnetic reversals at the bottom of the ocean. Don't let them tell you there are. I was just a few weeks ago standing right on top of the San Andreas Fault. There's no question, folks, the Earth is cracked up, and those cracks are moving. And when they move, the whole building might fall down. That happened. Called an earthquake. But how does that fit into the Bible? Well, the textbooks are going to say the Mid-Atlantic Ridge is lifting up and moving out, and then the ocean floor is being subducted. It's being recycled, being pulled under by Hawaii. I was just in Hawaii a few months ago, and there's no question there's volcanoes. We went and stood right on top of one. Yes, there's volcanoes, and there's a lot of activity. I've been on top of probably 20 volcanoes in my life, climbing them. There's no question there's volcanoes around the world. But is the Mid-Atlantic Ridge spreading the way to explain that? Well, let's talk about this. And another thing to consider in all this is when it rains, the mountains are eroding. They're washing into the ocean. Erosion takes place. At the current rate of erosion, the mountains will erode flat in 14 million years. Well, if that's the current rate of erosion, and assuming that's been going for some time like they want us to believe, then the continents would have eroded flat about 300 times since some of the fossils got formed. How can we still have fossils that are 300 times older above surface of the ocean? They would have been washed out to sea 300 times. Other problem is when this dirt washes off the mountains, it goes into the oceans, and the oceans are filling in with sediment. There's a bunch of mud down at the bottom of the ocean. Everything's washing off the land, ends up down there someplace. But there's only enough mud at the bottom of the ocean to represent a few thousand years worth of accumulation. So how does this fit into the Bible? I think that's a good proof, by the way, that the Earth is not millions of years old. So we'll talk about all these things, and I'm going to give you the Hovind theory. One thing you have to consider, just because we see something moving now, like Florida or California is moving north, you know, and compared to the rest of America, that's true. But does that mean it's always been happening? No, it might have just started. For instance, I live in Pensacola, Florida, right by Interstate 10, right there. Interstate 10 goes from Los Angeles all the way to Jacksonville, Florida. Now, if I see somebody headed down Interstate 10 going east toward Jacksonville, and they're going 70 miles an hour, does that prove they started in Los Angeles 4 days ago? Well, no. They might have just got on the interstate at the last exit, right? Just because you see somebody moving a certain direction does not mean it's always been moving that direction. And just because we see California moving north does not mean that's always been going on for millions of years. That might have all just started at the time of the flood. And I think that's what happened. The flood started all that. So we're going to answer some of these questions in just a second here. Continental plate movement does not prove they've always been moving. Yes, they're moving now. It could have happened at the flood. It does not prove the rate we're seeing today is what has always been going on. And students, I think, ought to be told there is sometimes more than one option. But I have never seen an earth science textbook, and I taught earth science for 15 years, I have never seen an earth science textbook that tells the students there's another way to look at this. They all present the Pangea theory as if this is the only way to look at it. They don't even consider there might be another option, like the flood in the days of Noah. Now, what about the Ice Age? Where does that fit in? Did ice come all the way down to Kansas City? Oh, yeah. Where does that fit into the Bible? Well, I'm going to give you the Hovind theory in just a few minutes and explain the whole thing. And what about these mammoths, the big, huge, hairy, hippie elephants that are frozen standing up? Some have 30-inch long hair. But it's interesting. The hair, at the base of the hair, they do not have the sebaceous glands, which is a gland to put oil on the hair. The mammoth, in spite of his long, hippie hair, was not designed for cold weather. It was a warm-weather animal. Could not survive in cold climates. They found one in 1901, frozen, standing up. The wolves had eaten his trunk and part of his head and one of his feet, but the rest of it was frozen in the muck. So they dug the mammoth out in 1901 and took it to a museum. It's still there in a museum in Russia where it was found. It's called the Beresovka Mammoth. They find thousands of mammoths. Estimates are there might be as many as 5 million mammoths that perished in one big catastrophe. They still go up and dig out the tusks and use the ivory. And the ivory is very good condition. It was frozen, not petrified. This is frozen ivory. One year, they dug out 20,000 pairs of tusks. what froze these mammoths? Mammoths found frozen in these, where these red dots are, all across Alaska and Siberia. They find frozen rhinoceros, frozen camels, frozen wolves. What happened up there anyway? Well, a couple things about the mammoth you need to understand. They're frozen standing up. There's undigested food still in their mouth and in their stomach. They didn't even swallow their last bite. They died of suffocation. There's no water found in the lungs. Well, how do you suffocate 5 million mammoths? Kind of strange. And there's small ice crystals in the blood indicating they froze in less than 4 or 5 hours. Well, I got curious about the mammoths. I wanted to find out, you know, what would it take to freeze an elephant? So I called a bunch of folks that I thought might have an answer for me. See, when you don't know something, ask somebody else who does know. That's why you go to school. That's why you try to learn things. That's why you have a teacher. They probably are a little older than you, and they probably know a few things you don't know, so it's okay to ask them questions. So I'm always asking questions when I don't understand something. I wanted to find out how long it would take to freeze a mammoth. So I called Bird's Eye Frozen Food People in New York. I figured, hey, they ought to know. They freeze food all the time. I said, excuse me, sir, if I stuck an elephant in the freezer, what would happen? Silence on the other end of the phone for a few minutes. Finally, the guy said, you'd have a crowded freezer. I said, well, yeah, I know that, but how long would it take to freeze an elephant? He said, well, it'll take about 5 days. I said, I can't wait 5 days. I need to freeze my elephant in less than 5 hours. He said, well, the only way you're going to freeze your elephant in less than 5 hours is to put him in liquid nitrogen, about 300 below zero. Well, folks, it never gets 300 below zero here on Earth. Never. Coldest it's ever been, if you look at the map of the South Pole from National Geographic, the map says the coldest ever recorded is 127 below zero. Well, that's pretty cold, but that's not cold enough to freeze the mammoths. We need something 300 below zero. So before I give you the Hovind theory of what I think did all these things, we need to review some science. Now, whether you learned this or not, I don't know, but it'll be review for some and new knowledge for others. First thing, there's a law in physics called the inverse square law. It sounds a little complicated, but it's not too bad. Here's the way it works. If two objects are attracted to each other, like the Earth and the Moon have gravity pulling them together, centrifugal force throws them apart, and they stay the same distance as it goes around. But the gravity pulling them together has a pretty strong force. If you move the Moon back into one-third the distance, if the Moon was one-third the distance away, you would take that fraction one-third, flip it over, inverse it, and square it. The pull of gravity would be 9 times as great if the Moon were one-third as close. Not 3 times as great, 9 times as great. That's called the inverse square law. Inverse square law says when the distance is halved, the attraction is quadrupled. It works when you're dealing with gravity, light, magnetism, and girls. A lot of guys don't understand this. See, when I get about 10 feet away from my wife, I travel every week. I've been home 5 Sundays in 7 years. Travel, gone someplace every weekend, come back home. Hi, dear, how you doing? When you half the distance, it's 4 times the attraction. When you half the distance again, it is too late. So, fellas, the secret is stay about 20 feet away and you won't have any problems, okay? That'll solve all your problems right there. But next thing you need to know in science, before this theory will make any sense, if a top is spinning, there's a peculiar way that it behaves. The spinning top. We're going to talk about that here. If a top is spinning and you throw something at it, like a piece of mud, and it sticks on the top, it'll make the top wobble for a while. And when it wobbles, it'll finally end up stabilizing, spinning smoothly, but it'll be spinning at a new angle. It'll be tilted over. You can tell when it was hit, actually, if you trace out on a graph the wobbling action of this top. You can trace back and see, well, something hit it. And you can tell about how long ago it got hit, just by the wobble. Next thing you need to keep in mind, there are some strange temples around this world, like Stonehenge. How many have ever heard of Stonehenge before? Stonehenge, nobody knows for sure why it was built or even when it was built. But apparently it was built to study the summer solstice shadow. The longest day of the year is June 21st, sometimes June 20th, but June 21st. And the shortest day is December 21st, or sometimes December 20th. It used to be December 25th was the shortest day, and that's why we have the Christmas on December 25th. It actually has pagan origins, that date does, but Christmas is, of course, a wonderful holiday to celebrate. But Stonehenge apparently was built to study the sun at June 21st, summer solstice, when the sun is as far north of the equator as it's going to get. See, the Earth is tilted over, and because of this tilt in the Earth, we have seasons. If the Earth were straight, going around, spinning like this while it goes around the sun, it would always be 12 hours daylight, 12 hours darkness. But because the Earth is tilted, as we go around the sun in the wintertime, we are tilted further away from the sun, and we get less shorter days, and it gets a little colder. And in the summertime, we end up being tilted toward the sun, and it gets a little hotter, and the days are longer. But that's interesting. The summer solstice shadow on June 21st, when the sun is as far north as it's going to get. Apparently, that's what Stonehenge was built to track, the summer solstice shadow. Well, a famous Australian astronomer named George Dodwell got together all the information he could find on what the old ancient people used to think was the angle of the Earth, based on the summer solstice shadow. He studied the recordings from Edexis and Amun-Ra and Stonehenge. He said the tilt of the Earth, if you graph it out on a timeline, makes a wavy line that is a match to the spinning top wavy line. He said it looks to him like something struck the Earth about 4,350 years ago. He graphed it out and said, looks like something struck the Earth right there. 4,350 years ago, that's about what the Bible says is the time of the flood. Could it be that something hit the Earth, made it wobble for a few thousand years? Still spinning, but just wobbling, North Pole changing position. And now the Earth is fairly stabilized, though still wobbling a little bit. Oh, could something hit the Earth and do that? Today the Earth is tilted over 23.5 degrees, and that's what causes the seasons. And by the way, the first mention of cold weather is after the flood. Genesis chapter 8 says, while the earth remaineth, seed time and harvest, and cold and heat, and summer and winter shall not cease. First mention of cold weather. See, if the earth wasn't tilted, you wouldn't have cold weather. It would be springtime everywhere, all the time. Interesting. Next thing to keep in mind, the moon has craters on it. So do lots of the planets have these big craters. And the craters on the moon are not evenly distributed. There seems to be more craters on one side than the other. If the moon got its craters slowly over billions and billions of years, you would expect the craters, just by pure chance, to be evenly distributed. But they're not evenly distributed on the moon. So what caused the craters anyway? You know, we've never seen the moon get hit by anything, except what we sent up there. A couple of astronauts and rockets had hit it, landed up there. But we've never seen the moon get hit by a crater, by a meteor. So what caused all these craters on the moon and on the other planets, Venus and or Mercury particularly? We'll talk about that in a minute. Next is things to keep in mind. If you can keep all this in mind, everybody got all this so far? All right. There's an effect called the Meissner effect. You ever seen one magnet floating on top of another magnet? You've seen those little games you can get where you take a magnet and you put the North Pole and the North Pole together and the magnet floats. It won't touch each other. The Meissner effect is when two magnets are floating on top of each other. So who cares? Well, now hang on, quit interrupting, and we'll get there. I'm going to share with you the Hovind theory of what I think caused all this, but you've got to have all this in your mind for it will make sense. Next thing, and almost the last thing to keep in mind, outer space is full of comets. These comets are flying around, great big, huge snowballs. Now, here in Florida, where we are today, you don't get a lot of snow. How many have ever seen snow before? Some of you have. Okay, it's that white stuff that falls out of the sky. You tell Florida kids about that, and they say, oh, yeah, seagulls. No. Snow. The reason God made snow is so you can pack it together into a ball and throw it at somebody. How many have ever done that before, throwing a snowball? Okay, that's the purpose of snow, God, so you can throw it at somebody. But the snowballs in outer space, these comets, are about 300 to 400 below zero Fahrenheit. Don't lick it. I'm going to need to find out here if anybody is or was as dumb as I was as a kid. How many of you have a piece of your tongue stuck to a pump handle or a flagpole someplace in the world right now? There you go. Never forget, my two big brothers, I got off the bus coming to school one real cold January day in Illinois. They said, hey, Kent, I bet you can't lick the flagpole. Yeah, I can. Go ahead, try it. And you just got to rip the skin off. That's all you can do. You don't want to lick something 300 below zero. That's for sure. Now, some of these comets flying around space are extremely cold, muddy snowballs. Actually, astronomers refer to comets as being a dirty snowball. Some are full of dirt and rock and iron and nickel. Most, though, are just chunks of ice. A lot of them are glued together. And the tail, they're glued together with ice. The tail coming off of a comet does not indicate which way it's traveling. It indicates the opposite way from the sun. The solar wind is blowing this comet apart, and that's actually chunks of ice and snow being blown off the comet. That's what causes the tail. So the closer it gets to the sun, the bigger the tail becomes. It has nothing to do with the speed of the comet or the direction of the comet. It only has to do with which way the sun is blowing. Actually, the comet can be moving into its own tail if the sun's blown that way. So just a bit of trivia. You'll get all that in earth science class when you should get that when you study it. If you throw a snowball too fast, though, something happens. If you threw a snowball too fast, it would break apart. You couldn't possibly shoot a snowball out of a cannon. It would come unglued before it made it out the end of the barrel. You say, who cares about all that? Well, I'm giving you the Hovind theory. Next, the Earth has a magnetic field around it, and this magnetic field of the Earth is what protects us from radiation. There's a lot of stuff that comes toward the Earth, but it is deflected around the North Pole and South Pole, and that's what causes the northern lights. I was up in South Dakota a couple months ago, and my son and I stayed out at this farmer's house. We were driving back from Wyoming, and the northern lights were real active that night. And we laid out on the back of the pickup truck and watched them for 2 hours. Just the sky lit up. It was the most gorgeous thing I've seen. You know, beautiful colors as the lights, northern lights streaking up toward the wherever they're going. They look like they started just off our head and took off. The northern lights is caused by the Earth's magnetic field. All right, next thing to keep in mind. The pre-flood world, the world before the flood, was very different than the world we have today. The Bible says it was protected by a canopy of water overhead, and also there was water under the crust of the Earth. Actually, it had the crust of the Earth with water and an atmosphere, and then water above the canopy, and then water under the crust. Now, there's still water in the crust of the Earth. You can drill down and get a well almost anywhere, but there apparently was a lot more water under the crust of the Earth before the flood came, and that's the water that came shooting out when the fountains of the deep broke open. And last thing to keep in mind, who was Peleg? Peleg. If you read the Bible in Genesis chapter 10, I hate to say this about the Bible, but Genesis chapter 10 is kind of a boring chapter. It's got all them big names in there, you know, so-and-so begat so-and-so, and he begat so-and-so. And you're reading through Genesis chapter 10, and you're saying, okay, come on, what's going on here? And all of a sudden, you come to verse 25. And it says, unto Eber were born two sons. The name of the one was Peleg. For in his days was the earth divided. Why would it say that? What do you mean the earth was divided? And then it says his brother's name was Joktan. Now, the word Joktan is a Hebrew word that means shortening. Peleg means divided. Joktan means shortening. So what happened in the days of Peleg anyway? Well, we're going to talk about that. Peleg was born about 100 years after the flood, and he was the first guy recorded in the Bible to live less than 400 years, except for Enoch, and he never died. See, before the flood, they lived 900 years. After the flood, it dropped off to 400. And then in the days of Peleg, it dropped off again, a lot, from 400 to 230. So what happened in the days of Peleg, and what was shortened? Why did they name Joktan shortening? Interesting. So this pre-flood world was very different. It had a canopy of water overhead and a bunch of water under the crust of the earth. The Bible says in Psalm 136, God stretched out the earth above the waters. Kind of a strange verse. That's the way it was when it was first built. There was a layer of water under the crust, as well as some water on top, you know, lakes and rivers and stuff, and oceans. And then a layer of air, which we still have, and then a layer of water above that. That's what the pre-flood world was like. And you got to keep in mind, like we mentioned in Seminar Part 4, there might be two ways to look at things, you know. How fast was that calf going? Now, kids, I made a decision years ago. I decided I'm going to believe the Bible until it is proven wrong. I know other people that have decided they're not going to believe the Bible until it is proven right. I think that's not a good decision to make. Like the atheist came to the preacher one day. The atheist said, I don't believe anything in the Bible. He said, you don't? He said, no, nothing. He said, I only believe what you can prove scientifically. He said, if you can prove something to me scientifically from that Bible, I'll believe it. The preacher said, well, okay. He grabbed the atheist around the head and grabbed his nose and began twisting his nose. Pretty soon the blood, of course, is pouring down his face. He said, man, what are you doing? He said, well, he told me to prove the Bible. It says in Proverbs chapter 30, the wringing of the nose bringeth forth blood. Just proving it to you scientifically, you know. I don't recommend you do that, but that is in there, folks. So I decided I'm going to believe the Bible until it's proven wrong. I think that's a safer way to do it. So now, with all that said, let me give you the Hoban theory of what I think happened. And I've studied this quite a while. I'm going to give you the order of events that I think happened and then go back and kind of review each of them just a little bit to try to put it into perspective of what happened to cause the flood. Noah and the animals went safely onto the ark. God shut the door, sealed them in. I think a 300 below zero Fahrenheit ice meteor came flying through the solar system and began to break apart. Fragments of this meteor hit the planets and caused the craters on the moon and other planets, and a bunch of it came and made the rings around the other planets. Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune all have ice rings around them, and some of the fragments of this meteor hit the Earth, landing on mostly the North and South Pole, freezing the mammoths standing up. As it approached the Earth, though, it shattered out in space because the inverse square law makes things go faster as they get closer. Gravity actually gets stronger. And so they would pick up speed and would reach the terminal velocity and blow apart like a snowball being thrown too fast. And this chunks of ice and snow would be sucked in and dumped around the North and South Pole because of the Earth's magnetic field. The sudden dump of ice on the North Pole and South Pole caused several things to happen. It caused the crust of the Earth to crack. The fountains of the deep were released and the water came shooting up out from under the crust of the Earth. This rapidly spreading ice from the being dumped on the poles pushed out toward the equator, caused the Ice Age, carved out the Great Lakes, scratched the rock all over northern Canada and Kelly's Island, Ohio, scratched all the rock, buried the mammoths, froze them standing up. For the next few thousand years, the Earth wobbled as because of this ice dumped on the North and South Pole, and it slowly stabilized to what we have today. During the first few months of the flood, the dead animals settled out, and some were floating around, swirling around on top, but those that got buried deep got buried down under the mud. And there were great piles of fossil animals found, whole herds of animals buried in this massive worldwide flood that later became the fossils that we have today. The dead plants that were buried turned into coal. The animals were turned into oil or natural gas, and they'd make these giant fossil graveyards over the next few hundred years. During the last few months of the flood, the unstable plates of the Earth, because it was now all cracked up, the plates of the Earth shifted and tilted. Some places went down, forming oceans. Other places lifted up, forming mountains. And the water rushed off, carving Grand Canyon, in a couple hours through soft sediments. Over the next few hundred years, these massive ice caps from Kansas City all the way up to the North Pole, they slowly melted back, which would raise the ocean levels and make the oceans colder and deeper and wider, separating the continents by the time you get to the days of Peleg, you know, about 100 years later. And the Earth today still shows the effects of that devastating flood. Just driving down the Blacktop Highway, you realize Blacktop's made out of oil and rock. Oil comes from people that drowned in the flood. Just driving down the highway, you can be looking for Grandpa. Oh, there he is right there. We just ran over. Okay. So I think Noah got all the animals safely on board the ark. God shut the door. The Lord said to Noah, come thou. Well, there's a good verse, kids. Hey, God did not say, go into the ark. He said, come into the ark. Now, in order for God to say, come into the ark, where did God have to be? In the ark, right? Otherwise, he would have said, Noah, go into the ark. See, and when God tells you to do something, it looks kind of frightening. He'll be with you. He was in there with Noah during the flood, no problem at all. God can handle things. He's under control. I don't mind going through a flood as long as God's on board. Like when Jesus was on the boat and the disciples were scared it was going to sink, he just stood up and said, okay, waves, lay down. Wind, stop. He can do that kind of stuff. If you ever want to go for a boat ride, take Jesus with you. That'd be a good guy to have along. The Lord said to Noah, come thou and all thy house into the ark. And he brought the clean beast and the unclean beast. He brought seven of some and two of others, at least two of everything, but seven of some of the animals on board the ark. And the Lord shut him in. By the way, that's a good verse. Just like when you get in Christ, God seals you in. You're safe. You're secure. You're going to heaven. Eternal security has to be a biblical doctrine. If salvation is by grace, it has to be eternal. There's no way you could lose your salvation. So this 300-degree ice meteor below zero came flying through the solar system and began to break apart. Fragments cratered the moon and Mercury and some of the planets, and they have craters on them. The interesting thing about these craters, there's a giant hole where something hit, but there's no evidence of what hit. A chunk of ice hitting these planets would make a big hole and then melt and then turn to steam and drift off into space, and there'd be no evidence except the hole. No meteorite is found there. As this meteor came flying through the solar system, it broke apart. Some of the fragments got caught in the gravitational field of Jupiter and Venus, Jupiter, Uranus, and Neptune, and they became the ice rings around those planets. Now, these planets have rings that are made of rock and ice. Any textbook will tell you that. Most of the rings are made of ice around these planets. I think that might have happened at the time of the flood. And as it approached the Earth, these fragments of meteor began to break apart even more, and it snowed mostly around the North and South Pole because the Earth has this magnetic field which protected it. See, super cold ice is easily statically charged. How many have ever seen one of those machines where you stand on it and put your hand on it and your hair stands up all over the place? That's called a Van de Graaff generator. Didn't work too good with me, but I've seen some folks who really get it standing up good. Doesn't work too good with you, Brother Greet, but we could try it with some other folks here. Van de Graaff generator makes things all statically charged and hair all stands up straight. Well, super cold ice is very easily statically charged. So just the friction hitting the atmosphere or just the fact that ice at low temperatures becomes magnetic, I'm not sure which it was, static or magnetic, but either one is going to tend to suck it in and dump most of it around the North and South Pole. As this meteor came flying in and breaking apart in space, the fragments would tend to be dumped largely around the poles because of the Earth's magnetic field. So the Earth had these massive cold spots, which made it rain for 40 days and 40 nights and totally covered the Earth with water. And plus the water shooting out from inside. We'll cover all that in a minute. See, if you lower the ocean levels a few hundred feet, the continental shelf becomes exposed. This is a picture of the North Pole, looking at it from the National Geographic magazine. You can see Greenland at the bottom right and Norway to the top right over there and Sweden and Finland. And to the top left, there is the new Siberian Islands, where they find frozen camels, frozen bobcat, jaguar, lynx. There's a whole list of a bunch of the animals that are found frozen and all the documentation in this book, In the Beginning, by Walt Brown. Tremendous book, by the way. If you want to get some of the information on things that are found frozen around the poles. It just is incredible the condition these things are found in. It's still found up there, I think, 4,400 years since it happened. When they drill down through the ice at the Greenland or at the South Pole, they find under the ice coal. Well, coal's made from plants. When they went to the South Pole, they found what's called the Dirty Diamond Mine, 1962, anthracite coal, under the ice, near the South Pole. Well, folks, there are no trees near the South Pole. There are zero trees in Antarctica. None. Certainly not enough to make coal, and there's as many as 30 or 40 layers of coal in some of these places. Admiral Byrd said when he went down there, they saw what looked like frozen palm leaves under the ice near the South Pole. Well, there are no palm trees. You can hardly get palm trees to grow in Pensacola, you know. It gets too cold in the winter and kills them off once in a while. And yet down at the South Pole, they find palm leaves? Scientists reported discovering the first set of dinosaur fossils found in Antarctica. Well, that's the bottom of the world, you know, the Antarctica way down here. Dinosaurs? Reptiles? They don't live good in cold weather. The fossils are said to be the remains of a plant-eating dinosaur 25 to 30 feet long. They lived about 200 million years ago. I would disagree strongly with that, but in what geologists call the Jurassic Age, the bones were spotted at a small section of exposed rock alongside the mountain, which lies about 400 miles from the South Pole. Frozen dinosaur bones. Also, the discovery of thousands of well-preserved leaves in Antarctica has sparked a debate among geologists over whether the polar region, rather than being blanketed by a massive sheet of ice for millions of years, enjoyed a near-temperate climate as recently as 3 million years ago. In January, Mr. Webb, with Dave Harwood, an assistant professor of geology at the University of Nebraska, and these other guys, found the deposit of leaves on the side of a cliff in a desolate stretch of the Transarctic Mountains, Antarctic Mountains, about 250 miles from the South Pole. The leaves, compressed by subsequent layers of ice, look like fossils, but unlike fossils, which leave only mineral traces, the leaves retain their original cellular structure. How are you going to get leaves at the South Pole? Even a few years ago, they discovered there are still chunks of ice hitting the atmosphere of the Earth. Chunks of ice as big as this church are hitting the Earth every day. Now they're being burned up on the way in, thankfully, being melted and vaporized, but it ends up being water added to space, added to our atmosphere. Next thought. The North Pole, there's actually two North Poles. There's the geographic North Pole, where we spin around. If you look at any globe, the place right there where the pin goes to is called the geographic North Pole. But up in Canada here, there's what's called the magnetic North Pole. Now, the Earth has two North Poles. The compass points toward the magnetic North Pole. Now, here in Florida, they line up. It's not a problem. But if you went over to Alaska, your magnetic North Pole, your compass would not point true north. You'd have to allow for all that. And anybody that flies an airplane up around that region knows you have to allow for how much your compass is off, because it doesn't really point true north. I think what happened, these mammoths were up there chomping on their tropical flowers. It was a beautiful day, about 70 degrees. They're eating buttercups. Seeds found in their stomach indicate it was warm weather, springtime. And all of a sudden it began to snow. The mammoths had never seen snow before. So one of them looked at the other one. He said, "Herman, it is snowing. Man, this is peculiar weather we're having. Let's get out of here, Herman." And so they began to run around trying to find a place to hide, and the snow got deeper and deeper and deeper as it began to snow this super cold 300 below zero snow on top of these mammoths. They ended up getting buried, and they suffocated in this snowbank and froze standing up. Froze in 3 to 5 hours because the snow was so cold. Buried them. As the ice went pushing out toward the equator, it carved out the glacier effects that we see. There are grooves in solid rock, grooves as deep as this building, for miles. As if a rock was slid across another rock, sliding across, scratching it. Glacial grooves found all over the place. And the ice went all the way down to southern Illinois. Yes, there really was an ice age. And as this mass of ice was on the North and South Pole, that's, of course, going to cause a cold front to come off of there, which is going to collapse the canopy. The Bible says the water above the atmosphere, it's mentioned several times in the Bible, this water above the atmosphere would, I think, begin to collapse, and it rained for 40 days and 40 nights. See, cold air, when it hits warm air, it makes it rain. You can open the freezer and see the cold air come out rolling onto the floor. How many have ever seen that before? Kind of a cold front coming out of your freezer. Sometimes the weatherman will say there's a Canadian cold front coming down across the Midwest. I heard that in Dallas, Texas, or somewhere near Dallas, they had the world record temperature drop. I don't know if I got the numbers right, but I think it went in 20 minutes from 100 degrees to 2 degrees on a cold front. Something similar. It's incredible. Almost 100 degree drop in just a few minutes as this cold front came in. Across. I think it was in Dallas or somewhere near there. But in Genesis chapter 7, God said, in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, 17th day of the month, the fountains of the great deep were broken up. All the fountains of the great deep were broken up. Apparently, there used to be water under the crust of the earth, and that got broken up, all of it, same day. All that water came shooting up to the surface. So this ice dumped on the North Pole would crack the crust of the earth and release the fountains of the deep, and they came shooting up to the top. Water that used to be underneath shot up to the top. And everything got cold, and the canopy collapsed overhead. They had water coming from both sides in the days of this flood, so Noah's friends and neighbors that weren't on the ark were out of luck. Genesis chapter 7, verse 19 tells us, all the high hills under the whole heaven were covered. You say, come on, is it possible to cover the earth with water? Well, theoretically, one drop of world will cover the water. One drop of water will cover the world if you spread it real thin. But yeah, there's enough water out there in the oceans to cover the earth about a mile and a half deep. I flew back over the Pacific coming back from Australia. I told one of the guys in my office, I said, man, the Pacific Ocean is huge. He said, that's just the top of it. I thought, man, that's a powerful thought. That was just the top of it. If you shrank the earth down to the size of a 12-inch globe like this one right here, all the water in the world would not even fill 2 tablespoons. Earth is actually pretty smooth compared to its size here. When they climbed Mount Everest in 1953, Edmund Hillary got up to the 26,000-foot level, and he began to find seashells. I got some stuff like here, like they found up there. Petrified clams. Seashells packed together. Millions of them. Interesting thing about these clams that are found even on top of the Mount Everest, the clams are petrified and dead, I believe, and closed. Well, you can walk along the beach and pick up a whole train load of seashells, but you hardly ever find a matched pair. And you never find them closed. The only way this could happen is he had to be buried alive. I've got a few buckets of these at home, people have given me. Petrified clams in the closed position. Why do you get these on top of Mount Everest? Well, in case you don't know, Mount Everest is a little ways from the beach. Secondly, clams don't climb mountains very good. So what happened to these petrified clams anyway? Some places they are 10 feet thick in the world. There's a guy up in Alabama said one day, Brother Hovind, you want some petrified clams? I said, yeah, why? He said, they're 4 feet thick in my backyard. Every time he rototills his garden, he brings up thousands of them. Petrified, closed clams. Well, the only way I can figure out for this to happen is there had to be an awful lot of clams buried instantly. I think during the flood, when the fountains of the deep broke open, you would get mudslides and you would bury them quickly. The Bible says all the fountains of the deep were broken up and the windows of heaven were opened. What I suspect happened is cracks in the crust of the earth let the water come shooting out, and the earth wobbled for a while from the weight of the ice being dumped on the North and South Pole, and you'd have a lot of things going on simultaneously to the poor folks outside of the ark. There wasn't much chance of survival for them. The earth cracked along the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, sort of like a balloon splitting. If you take a balloon and you blow it up real big and you poke one hole in one side, how long does it take for the other side of the balloon to split? Almost instantly, right? That crack spreads around the balloon just like that. Well, I think that happened to the earth. The earth split open. The fountains of the deep came shooting out. Hot water came shooting out from inside the crust of the earth. And this hot water came out to the top, probably shot way up into the stratosphere. As it went shooting out along these cracks, it would erode the sides of the cracks, adding lots of mud to the water. And this mud's going to spread out everywhere. You get sediment layers everywhere, all over the earth, from this mud spreading out. It might even push the continental plate a little bit. And the pushing of these plates sliding, as long as the water's underneath for lubricant, you'd get the plates actually sliding, and they would smash into another plate and wrinkle up the mountain ranges that we see. The Mid-Atlantic Ridge, as the plates slid back, the bottom of it, the basalt underneath, lifted up and bulged, and split open as it bent, and that splitting caused the water to go down in and made the Mid-Atlantic ridge lines that we see. This mountain range here in southern British Columbia obviously was wrinkled up like an accordion. I think one of the plates of the earth smacked another one and wrinkled it up like that. So it's a horizontal compression, not just lifting up, but being compressed like that, wrinkling it like that. And this hot water, when it came shooting up out of the fountains of the deep came shooting up, the hot water shooting out is going to kill creatures that live in the oceans right near where the water hits it. How many of you have an aquarium? Anybody got an aquarium at home? If you go home and pour a gallon of boiling water into your aquarium. What's going to happen to the fishies? It'll be belly up, right? Floating around. But not if your aquarium, is huge. If you got a giant aquarium and you pour in just a cup of boiling water in the corner, it's only going to kill the fish within a certain effective radius. You're not going to kill all the fish. So if the fountains of the deep broke open, the hot water would come shooting out from inside the earth, and it would kill the diatoms within a certain effective radius, maybe a few hundred miles. They would all die. Now, diatoms are beautiful, little bitty glass-bodied creatures that live in the ocean. You can't see them without a microscope. But when they die, they fall to the bottom. And when their grandkids die, they fall to the bottom, and the great-grandkids, and pretty soon there's a bunch of dead diatoms at the bottom of the ocean. They say it would take about 1,000 years to get 1 inch of dead diatoms. When that stuff, if it ever dries out and turns into rock, it makes what is called diatomaceous earth. They dig that diatomaceous earth out. I was just in Lompoc, California a few months ago, where they've got the largest diatomaceous earth quarry in the world. I toured all over that place, drove around, talked to the guys, the manager there. They use this diatomaceous earth to make swimming pool filters, detergents, fertilizers, insulation, soundproofing, paper finish, bricks, paint thickeners, oil dry, cat litter. You know the white stuff you put out for the kitty? That's diatomaceous earth. They use it for paint remover, scores of other things. In Lompoc, California, just north of L.A., I was there just a couple months ago, this town is right on top of the San Andreas Fault, one of the cracks in the earth's crust. They were digging a diatomaceous earth quarry in Lompoc, California, back in 1976 at the dicalcite division of Grefco Corporation. While they're digging, they dig out this diatomaceous earth to sell it. They were digging along, and they found the fossil skeleton of a baleen whale. The whale was standing on end and was 80 feet long. Now, the whale was standing up, but the layers were also tilted up. So it's not really the 80 feet length of the whale that makes the problem. It's the thickness of the whale that makes the problem. But still, it's a problem because diatomaceous earth accumulates very slowly. Well, how do you get this whale to not rot for millions of years while it slowly forms around it? I was there at the museum in Lompoc, California, where they've got a dolphin on display that they dug out of diatomaceous earth. The guy gave me a chunk of diatomaceous earth, which has hundreds, in just that one little chunk of diatomaceous earth, hundreds of fish fossils. I've got it in my office. If you come to Pensacola, come on over, I'll show it to you. The whole big, huge rock, this thick, only weighs about 1 pound. Extremely light, diatomaceous earth is. And yet they find millions, if not billions, and some people have said there might even be trillions of fish buried in this diatomaceous earth, including some big ones like the whale. The guy told me they hate to stop when they find a fossil. If they let somebody know we found a fossil, they're going to stop production while they come very carefully dig it out. Well, meanwhile, they're trying to make a living digging out this diatomaceous earth and selling it. He said one night, the night crew, they were digging away these layers of diatomaceous earth, and they found the fossil of a pterodactyl. The rock splits in nice, neat layers. And this pterodactyl, when they got it all exposed, one guy took a picture of it, and I haven't got the picture yet, but I really want to. It was 60-foot wingspan pterodactyl right there on the side of the diatomaceous earth rock layer. That would be the world's biggest, if it's true. 52-foot, so far, is the world's biggest. But he said they didn't want to stop production, so they just took a picture and kept digging. But they do find literally billions of fossils, stuff buried in this diatomaceous earth. When you go to England, you see the chalk cliffs over there, solid chalk, 300 feet thick. I mean, you can dig out a piece of your yard and write on the chalkboard with it. What happened in England? Well, don't tell me all the chalk critters in the world that make up the chalk formations. Don't tell me they all decided to go to Dover to die for millions and millions of years. I think there was a catastrophe that formed that. The Bible says the waters prevailed and went and were increased greatly upon the earth, and the ark went upon the face of the waters. I think what happened during the first couple of months of this flood, which lasted 12 months, by the way, the flood did, during the first few months, dead animals settled out. and they became the fossil graveyards that we see today. And some were floated to the top and rotted and began to fall apart, and things began to petrify. Some of the animals were swirling around in this moving water, and they would become disarticulated is the word, which means they rot and fall apart. See, moving water automatically separates particles based upon their density. You get water to move rapidly, and the heavier stuff drops out first, and then lighter stuff drops out last. You can go out in the yard and get a jar of dirt, add some water, shake it up, set it down, it'll settle out into layers for you. Moving water does that. How many have ever seen those things with the two pieces of glass and different colored sand in between, and you flip it over and it settles out and makes all these fancy patterns? You ever seen those? You can play with them for hours, never make the same pattern twice. Well, I think the flood did that same type of thing very rapidly. In Wyoming, there's a place called the Green River Formation where the atheists and evolutionists will say, look at this, this took millions of years to make all this. They'll say there's millions of layers in the Green River Formation. Well, that's true. And they say each one represents a year. That's not true. You can take a piece of that Green River Formation, get a big chunk of rock, grind it back into powder, and dump it out on the table. Just dumping it on the table. If you cut through the pile you just made, you'll see it re-stratified. You can take different densities of sand, just like they do with the things, the two pieces of glass in there, and just simply dumping it will cause it to automatically stratify. As the earth was turning, and during this flood, of course, you'd get little eddies and whirlpools and things going around from the worldwide flood, and the dead animals would tend to rot and be caught in these whirlpools, and they would fall apart. The head falls off, the tail falls off, the ribs fall off, and you would end up with, later, a tangled up mess of dinosaur bones. In Colorado, there's or Vernal, Utah, and in Colorado, there are dinosaur graveyards. Actually, quite a few dinosaur graveyards around the world. Notice this dinosaur. The backbone has no ribs, no head, no tail, no legs, and no teeth marks. The other backbone behind it is bent backwards. That's the way they find dinosaurs, in tangled up messes. In Wyoming, a famous dinosaur discoverer on a ranch owned by Baker Howe, who lived at the foot of Bighorn Mountains in Wyoming, the concentration of fossils was remarkable. They were piled in like logs in a log jam. What would cause that? Tangled up messes of fossils. I got one right here on the table, just a little slab of it. If you go to Texas, go to Houston, and start heading east a few miles, and you come to the San Jacinto Monument. That's where the Mexicans finally met their match. You know, they slaughtered us at the Alamo. Boy, at San Jacinto, we got them back. And they built a big monument there to this battle, the San Jacinto Monument. It is all made out of giant blocks of stone containing thousands, if not millions, of fossils. These fossils that are found all over the world oftentimes are packed into tight sediment layers. I mean, what would cause the fossil formation that we see? In Belgium, back in 1878, remarkable concentration of iguanodon skeletons, that's a dinosaur, was discovered 1,000 feet below ground in a Belgian coal mine. Thus, it could be seen that the fossil boneyard was evidently one of gigantic proportions, especially notable because of its vertical extension through more than 100 feet of rock. How do you get 100 feet of petrified animals? We have to have a big flood. I think the fossil evidence is overwhelming evidence for a flood. Now, of course, the devil has tricked people into thinking you can use the fossils as proof for evolution, when actually it's proof of God's judgment on this world. Fossils are proof of God's judgment. This quote here, much to my surprise, the book documented literally hundreds, not just a handful, of well-exposed dinosaur track sites. In other words, dinosaur footprints, trails of dinosaurs, spread all over the world. Tracks, trackways, nests, eggs, and coprolites, petrified dino doo-doo, of the reptilian masters of the Mesozoic are chronicled from all over the world. And the record is an impressive one indeed, in terms of not only abundance and geographic distribution, but also of quality of preservation. Lockley and Gillette reported more than 400 dinosaur track sites in North and South America alone, and they especially note 12 large localities around the world that contain more than 1,000 individual tracks and or greater than 100 different trackways each. I've been to see dinosaur trackways or footprints preserved in Connecticut. I saw them at the Red Rock River Red Rock Amphitheater in Denver, Colorado. I've been to Glen Rose, Texas. Been to Massachusetts, Holyoke, where the dinosaur footprints are. There are these dinosaur footprints preserved in rock all over. What happened anyway? Well, I think there was a worldwide flood. That's the obvious explanation of all this. Robert Bloom, the South African paleontologist, estimated there are 800,000 million skeletons of vertebrate animals in one formation in Africa. 800,000 million. 800 billion. Almost a trillion vertebrate animals with backbones in one layer of rock. Well, folks, you can go out west where they killed the buffalo, and they killed literally millions of buffalo in the last 200 years trying to starve the Indians out. Millions of buffalo were slaughtered. And I would defy you to find me one fossilized buffalo. They didn't fossilize because they weren't buried. The only way to get a fossil is to bury it real quickly. And soft-bodied animals are found fossilized, worms fossilized. Well, how long would a worm last before it would rot? Or, you know, jellyfish, fossilized. Very minute detail. I think the flood is the only explanation of all this. So what I think happened, the petrification began to take place right away when animals were buried in these sediment layers because of this worldwide flood. And things can petrify very quickly. This seminar will be continued on the next tape.